So we are in the message series, Seeking God. You see it right up there, sermon series. And this message is all about having a heart for God. What does it mean to have a heart for God? And we've been following the Old Testament figure, David. Before he became king, he was just a shepherd boy, and God brought him from his place and time out in the sheep pasture all the way to the throne as king of Israel. And here today we find ourselves in chapter 9 of 2 Samuel. And David has already once again defeated a threatening military force, and the kingdom is at peace. And usually when kings are at peace, they start thinking about policies and procedures that they can create to make their kingdom a very wealthy place. They think about how they can create policies and procedures for the people in their kingdom that will extend their peace. And in chapter 9, what we find is that David thinks about justice. We don't oftentimes see kings thinking about justice for those who are marginalized and those who are on the outskirts, but this is what David does. He takes a very radical and just approach at restoring relationship. So David is not just a man who seeks God for himself. He is a man who seeks God for others by acting justly. But David also has a habit of this. It's not something that we read about in chapter 9 that is odd or uncommon for David. You remember when Micah preached about having tailor-made worship, that in the worship time, David distributed food throughout the entire kingdom for free. And last week when we talked about David praying to build God a temple, and God said no, David went right to work preparing for the future generation, giving of his resources and his time and his energy, doing this act of justice. David has a heart for justice. That's the title of our message today. And it begs the question, well, how do we cultivate this heart for justice? One of the phrases we say around here, it's actually just the one phrase, the main idea for today, is that what you wish you could do for many, do for one. What you wish you could do for many, do for one. Because justice sometimes seems like this big thing. How can we tackle the issues that are facing the marginalized people, oppressed people? How is it that we even get engaged in this work? It's too big, it's too massive, and so I can't get involved. We normally say this around the month of November for Foster Care and Adoption Month, that we would love to rescue all of the fatherless children, but what we wish we could do for many, some do for one. Now, there are hundreds of verses that speak of God's heart for justice. And about poverty alone, there are more than 2,000 verses in the Bible. Listen to what David says in Psalm 89:14. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Love and faithfulness go before you. And much of the Old Testament is about revealing the attributes of God's heart for righteousness and justice that are connected together. In Proverbs, David's son Solomon says this in Proverbs 29:7, the righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. Again, we see that righteousness is activated in justice, and particularly for the poor. And one of the saying, of course, goes like this. Well, I may feel bad for the poor. I might feel heavy, but if I'm not actively involved, I'm not pursuing righteousness or justice. We cannot be holy people if we are not activating our righteousness in the form of justice. Because doing nothing is not an option. Sitting on the sideline and watching it is not an option. The old folks called this a sin of omission. And it's every bit as serious as a sin of commission, one that you intended to do. throughout the scriptures. The Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Micah, and Nahum, are particularly focused on the omission of justice by Israel. They had forgotten who they were, and God sent prophets to remind them who they should be. Listen to this one from Micah 6:8. Maybe it sounds familiar. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. This is the seed verse for Sanctuary Columbus. This Micah 6:8 is what we were founded upon. When you go out in the hallway and you sit in front of that nice orange leather chair, on the wall it says, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. They're not just words on a wall. They're meant to be words on our hearts. That we would be people who grow to love mercy even more. We would be people who grow to do justice even more. We would be people who walk more humbly with our God. King David embodies this. Let me read to you the story found in 2 Samuel chapter 9. David asked, verse 1, is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now, there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? At your service, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness? And Ziba answered the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet. Well, where is he? The king asked. Ziba answered, he is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lodabar. So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, Mephibosheth! At your service, he replied. Don't be afraid, David said to him, for surely I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Mephibosheth bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table, and he was lame in both feet. Father, this is the word of the Lord. Let it fill our minds, flow from our mouths, and free our hearts to live as the beloved children of God. Now, a little bit of background here. What happened, you may be wondering, to this young man named Mephibosheth? He's the grandson of King Saul, the one who preceded King David, and the son of Jonathan, who was David's best friend. This young man was born into royalty, destined to take the throne, and his future was bright, and as a child, he was raised by loving nurses, people who treated him with great kindness and made sure to meet every single one of his needs because they were dealing with a future king. But when he was 5 years old, his father and his grandfather, King Saul, were both killed in battle. News spread to Mephibosheth's nurses. They grabbed him and rushed out of the house and in the rush dropped him. Anybody ever drop a child before? It's scary. Isn't this scary? They don't always bounce back. Sometimes they kind of rubbery, they do. Mephibosheth did not. As he was dropped, He broke both feet and he became lame instantly. The nurse picked up Mephibosheth and drew him away to a secret place called Lodebar. Yes, she was trying to save his life and with good intentions, only to have a detrimental impact. Both legs broken. Sometimes in life, we go through brokenness. Sometimes of no doing of our own, we suffer the consequences of someone else's mistake. We suffer the effects that someone else decided for us. And in shame, we try to hide ourselves away. This was Mephibosheth, crippled by his physical legs and feet not working the way he wanted them to. Some of us find ourselves crippled. Maybe we're crippled by low self-esteem, or maybe we're crippled by addictions, or crippled by depression, or crippled as Mephibosheth was by shame and heaviness. He was taken to a place called Lodebar, which means forgotten. The physical place where he lived, where he dwelled, was called Forgotten. And his name, Mephibosheth, means shameful. Can you imagine living in a place called Forgotten, where you literally feel the effects of being forgotten? People don't remember who you are. I can't remember your name. In fact, when they call you by some other name, a name that doesn't quite speak to the destiny of who you are. Anybody see where I'm going? David enters into this story, but not until we understand the crippling effects that Mephibosheth had to go through. I've actually preached this message before. You can go back in the archives. The message was called A Seat at the Table. And I preached that message after one of the police brutality incidents where an African-American man was shot. And I asked the question, is there a seat at the table for me, for us? David, when he looks at this situation, in order to have a heart for justice, he begins with a question of compassion. It's uncommon for a king to be concerned about anyone that's not in their kingdom. But David is not a common king. He's not common. He asks the question, is there anyone alive from the family of Saul and Jonathan to whom I can show kindness? He's looking out beyond. He particularly should not be asking this question because any remnants of Saul and Jonathan would be considered enemies to David. And it's difficult for us to imagine compassion for our enemies. It's difficult for us to imagine compassion for those who perhaps are far different from us. My two boys and I, the two older ones, are doing a devotional online on the life of MLK as told through the lens of his daughter, Dr. Bernice King. And in our recent reading, she recited the verses that speak of compassion for our enemies in Matthew 5:44. But I tell you, Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. And so it brings up the question, church, who's your enemy? Is it the person who practices a religion different from you? Is it someone who speaks a language different from you? Is it someone who has a sexual orientation different from you? Someone who lives in a part of town different from you? Who has a different skin color and racial identity that is different from you? who shares politics and views on government different from you? Who really is your enemy? Now, our minds tend to go to the one we despise. That's the enemy. But let me offer this. An enemy is anyone who is difficult to get along with and who is just plain different. That pushes the envelope a little bit, doesn't it? It pushes it a little closer to the heart. The person you're least likely to show compassion to and towards is because of their difference. King David broke the system of difference. He broke the structure of different by asking the question, there's somebody out there that I need to show kindness to. And he searched, and he searched, and he searched. When I think about who my enemy is, sometimes it goes to all of those places I just read out to you. When I hear somebody espouse a politics that's different from mine, kind of bristles on my neck. When someone challenges my beliefs, my religious beliefs, I bristle a little bit. It leads me away from compassion, where God wants me to be drawn into compassion. God is the one who is quite different from all of us, and yet God does not choose to keep us far apart. And this is what David does. Listen, David doesn't keep Mephibosheth far. He actually brings him quite close. This is a response of proximity. He says, bring him here. Where is he? Bring him here. I want to meet him. I want to spend time with him. I want to learn about him. And it's completely uncommon for a king to get proximate to one person's issue. He's not a common king. A king would normally leave this to somebody else to go do. He'd give the assignment to someone else, but King David does not volunteer someone else. He does it himself. And beloved, it's too far easy for us to judge someone when they are at a distance from us. It's too easy to formulate opinions about solving problems without being close to the people who are affected by those problems. It's too easy to go about our lives without being proximate, but we do this. Sociologists call this social distancing, and it refers to the grades and degrees of understanding and intimacy which characterize our pre-social and social relations in general. It means when someone is different than you, you choose not to be proximate. You choose not to be intimate. You choose not to be understanding. You choose not to learn. And history, over and over throughout our history in America, is about socially distancing ourselves from one another, at times by force or by choice. We're pit against each other because of our history. We are not a united nation. We are a grieving, hurting nation. But let me not just speak about the nation. Let me speak about the church. We are a grieving and we are a hurting church. The church was never intended to be divided racially, economically, by gender. It was not meant to be a place where you would just go with people who all share the same values as you. It was meant to be a beautiful mosaic of color, of culture, and identity. That's what the church was supposed to be. It is who the church is supposed to be. And God has not given up on that church. God hasn't given up on it because redlining has pushed people and marginalized people into segregated communities. If you don't know what redlining is, Google it. Our inability to acknowledge the injustice of African slavery and its Jim Crow counterpart and its mass incarceration child keeps us hindered from being able to accurately work towards solutions that will bring about unity, the unity we pray for, the unity that we're here to worship God in. If we remain socially distant, friends, from immigration or mental illness, we are making a statement that our heart is not for justice, it is for just us. When we think about what is just good for us and we don't take the steps that David took to get proximate, our heart breaks right along with God's. So David gets personal. David gets into a conversation with Mephibosheth. He finds out the history. What happened? How did you get lame? How did you break your feet? Man, where you been? He learns that his name means shameful and that he was living in a place called forgotten and isolated. And this does not make sense to David. But we've got some people in this church who have gotten proximate to one another. Over the last several years, Sanctuary has been sending people on a trip called Sankofa. It's a West African word that means go back and get it so that you can go forward. It's about taking an honest look of the past in order to move forward into the future. We've taken, how many folks here? I forgot today. 19 people so far from Sanctuary have been on this Sankofa trip, and we got 8 more planning to go in March. It's a part of the denomination, the Evangelical Covenant Church that Sanctuary is a part of. They put this trip together with about 30 to 40 people, get on a very tight tour bus, and they start in Chicago, and they drive all the way down to Alabama, Selma, Alabama, Memphis, Tennessee, visiting museums and watching stories and exchanging knowledge, feelings with one another. And Bob Borghese and Michael Hill went on, I don't know which one y'all went on, I can't remember. It was the last one? Oh, okay. They went on the last one. And come on up, guys. Grab that microphone right there. They want to share about their, it's right there in the front. There. Yeah, you can grab a chair. Carter, get a chair for Bob. There you go. Man, go ahead. You old, man. Go ahead and get your chair. You starting, Michael? Let me make sure that thing is on. Hello? Bob is starting? Okay. Do you know that, Bob? Hello? Hey. I don't think it's on. Hello? It's not on. It's on, but y'all can't hear nothing. Here, try this now. Say something.
Hey.
All right, he got it.
Hey there.
Well, most of you know I've been coming to Sanctuary for 7 years. I got baptized here at Sanctuary. And my name is Michael Hill.
I'm Bob Borghese. I've been coming here. This is the 4th location I've been at.
Oh, okay.
So, about 9.5 years. And I've lived in the Linden area my whole life. There was a time I lived in West Linden. Some people call it Clintonville. But our perspective is Linden is the center of Columbus, right? So we've been, so it's interesting. Mike and I, about the same age. We've grown up in the same location. And yet, our lives are different. I mean, look at it. I mean, I've experienced white privilege my whole life. And so part of spending time with Mike on Sankofa was just being as a black man for 3 days. So I'll talk about that more later. But I want Mike to share his story.
Well, I am a descendant of slaves. I can trace my history back to 1861. when we went on the St. Colpa trip, and I was able to go to the Leontine Wall and carry my family's tree, my family's book with me. It didn't hit me until I touched the wall. It was like my spirit was crying, my heart was crying, my soul was crying. But I had just before Bob. Hayes Turner, his wife Mary Turner, she complained about her husband being cheated. And she complained over and over again until they lynched her. She was 8 months pregnant at the time. And they not only lynched her, but they tortured her. They tied her up from her ankles upside down. They doused her with gasoline. They caught her on fire. They cut her stomach open. Baby falls out on the ground. They stomp the baby to death. But before they stomp the baby cried 2 to 3 times before they stomp the baby to death. Their cases, their lynching and their cases went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. It's hard on me,
mm-hmm.
because I have to keep reliving this, but the story.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
the next one is you and Bob and Selma walking across the bridge.
So part of this trip was, me and Michael, like me being with Michael 3 solid days. So it's like I said, being as a black man for 3 days and just seeing the torment, seeing the emotional pain, seeing what he's been through. And this picture was taken, we kind of snuck up on the bridge a little bit because we were supposed to wait, but me and Michael were impatient. So we got up there and somebody took a picture of us going up there. And this was supposed to be the Freedom Bridge. This is the one that Martin Luther King walked across. On the other side, there were dogs and there were water jets and all that other stuff. So just that part of history, just being part of history. So part of the St. Colpa trip was just, as I've said before, I think every white person should be taking this trip because it's us that don't know the history. Like Rich said, Black History Month for white people is February. For them, it's all year. History looks back. So to go forward, we need to understand their history. And, as Michael and I crossed that bridge and came across the other side, we saw, the other side was freedom. And yet there were people opposed to that. So just seeing that really, just found stuff. So, kind of where we were at. So I encourage anybody to go on this trip and just share that experience. I'm going to read a little poem that came out of Michael's family tree. His family has put together a book of all the relatives and how they survived. So Michael will probably talk about that if you want to talk about it. But David's done an extensive family tree, and that's how some of the story came out.
So I asked Brother Bob to past lived within your blood. so there is life. You are chosen to be the link that brings your family chain together.
Listen to the voices of old family members as they call out from within your blood. Feel their hurt, understand their pain of the past. They talk to you through your genes.
Your genes never die. They are passed on to each family member. Without death, there could be no life. The heart holds every loved one. The mind stores the memory of them.
Your life is not your own. You are only part of a seed. In time, a person is picked in each family and molded before they are born and chosen to be the voice of the old and the present, so there can be hope and understanding for the future.
Let not your thoughts be troubled. Let your mind be open. Use your inner vision to open the doors of the past to bring peace and love. Turn the hurt of the past seed into love, hope, and understanding.
Bring your faith to God. Let the story be told from your heart. Peace unto you, love in the name of Jesus.
Amen.
Carter West. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Michael. The last thing that King David does, in order for him to cultivate this heart for justice, is he acts in justice. Not injustice. He acts in justice. When he calls him back, he says, all right, everything that belonged to King Saul belongs to Mephibosheth now. Some people might call that reparations. Everything that was taken, everything that you didn't get, everything that was, you lived in shame for all of these years. Hey, listen, now you get everything that the king has. It's yours. And what's even more is that now you get a seat at my table. You will be like one of my own sons, enjoying the fruit of our relationship. When Mephibosheth does this, you can read later on in his story, when he has all of those things taken away from him again, actually the Ziba, the one who David said, hey, you got to farm his land and you got to make sure that he's provided for. Ziba said, okay. And then later on, Ziba turned his back on David because he didn't like having to serve. He didn't like having to give up his stuff. He felt like he should have had it. So Ziba actually contrived a plan that he told David, Mephibosheth don't like you. He got a plan out to kill you. And took all his stuff, and Mephibosheth went in hiding again. And then when David finally caught up with Mephibosheth and was ready to lay the hammer down on him, Mephibosheth said, no, that's not true. I don't even want any of that stuff. I just want a relationship with you, King. The act of justice that David did was not simply in restoring possessions to Mephibosheth. It was restoring relationship. Justice is a relational word. It is bringing two entities, two bodies, two people together so that they could become one in their new relationship. And whatever resources it needs to go through in order to restore and make that relationship happen, it goes through those kind of links. What does it mean for our relationship to be restored to one another? What links might we go to see that our hearts are continuously cultivated for justice? Unless you think that I'm just talking about race, I'm talking about wherever we find marginalized people, that we would cultivate the heart of justice, that we, like David, would ask the question of compassion, that we would get proximate to the person, and then we act in justice. And what we wish we could do for everyone, we say, listen, this is what I can do for this one person right here. There's so much more I can say, but it's already 11:25. And y'all are probably thinking about wings and football and all of that. He said, no, I ain't even thinking about it. I like you. Are you all right with me? Oh, man. I don't even know what to say, y'all. Let me say this. What's your takeaway? All those steps I just talked about. But I want you to also pray for us as a church. So we used to have this ministry called the Compassion and Justice Ministry. It was awesome. You know, that Micah 6:8 verse, it was what we started on. And before we even had a Sunday worship service, we were going out and we were serving communities and we were serving people and we were getting real proximate to issues. And over time, due to changes in leadership of that ministry, as well as changes in location, we haven't been as active corporately in the act of compassion and justice. There's individuals, we have awesome partners, Connie with Chloe, which serves single moms, and Aaron and Emily Starr with RT&I down in Milo Grogan, and even how we're partnering with Metro, you know, Young Life. These are awesome. Can't forget the Riverview, you know, which is a resource for refugees and immigrants. We have all of these partnerships, and these partnerships are right here in this church, but collectively, we could be doing more. And not more in terms of like more activity, but more strategically, we could be doing more. So let me just end there, because I'm a wreck today. I'm just a mess. If I feel like I stand up here, I don't know what I'm going to say, Stuart. I'm just going to keep going. So I'm going to stop there. Y'all pray for Sanctuary so that we can get back on this collectively. I want y'all to do it and individually. And matter of fact, let me end in prayer. So I know the worship team has a song prepared, but let me just ask y'all, huddle up together. And I'm going to ask that you would pray for compassion and justice. And if there are issues, maybe you're familiar with some area of brokenness. Katie Lee, she serves with a ministry called She Has a Name, reaching women who are trafficked in the sex trafficking industry to bring the gospel, you know, to those women. You know, maybe there's other issues that come to your mind. I'm going to ask that you would pray for those issues. Pray for our church. I'm going to give us about 5 minutes or so for y'all to pray together. Is that all right? Can y'all do that? A couple shaking heads. All right. Good. Y'all go ahead and circle up, or, you know, 3 or 4 people together, pray. Yeah, compassion and justice. Go ahead.